just now we discussed, Simon and I discovered something, and I think it's true, is that the time in the morning that you have from like when your alarm goes off to when you need to leave your place.
Get out the door, yeah.
That is when time moves the fastest.
It's a time warp, I think. Yeah.
There's something that happens there. We could have used, we need the great minds of our time. We need the Oppenheimer guys, the Oppenheimer crews. Well, they start going to Berkeley and they're like,
put a bunch of guys in the desert.
What do you got on that chalkboard? And they're like, lots of calculations. I'm like, those are looking good. That's basically all I got out of Oppenheimer, by the way.
Yeah, people went to the desert and had chalkboards.
Or no, when I was like, yeah, that was cool. And then Sean Avery was in it. And then I was like, that was really long. What was the point? I wasn't a big Oppenheimer guy. I'm just going to say it.
Sounds like it.
I just thought it was too long. It was too long. And guess what? This is gonna. I'm starting the day like this, okay? I'm starting the day like this because I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good, and this is how I'd like to start the day, with violence. You're all sitting there, and some of you are just driving. Some of you are just sitting at your desk. Some of you are podcasting this right now, being like, yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing what JD has to say today. I think Christopher Nolan got to be the most overrated guy who ever lived. Yeah, it's like I every time a Christopher Nolan movie comes out, the Christopher Nolan heads are like, oh!
Wow.
And then we see it. It's like, here's what I think. That Batman movie, the second one, was one of the best movies that I've seen, like entertaining, awesome movies, straight up ever. And I know it's weird because it was a Batman movie, but it was
really good.
So good.
Yeah.
And then all the rest of them are like,
okay, so just quickly, Inception.
Overrated. Way overrated.
Interstellar.
The most overrated.
Okay, Memento.
I really like Memento. I forgot about Memento, but I really do like Memento.
Yeah.
But I will say that, like, the twist is a little overrated. But,
sure.
Like, but the concept of it is really sick, and it was cool, and the tattoos. And I remember even, like, back in the day being at, like, Roger's Video.
Yeah. So I remember, like, I saw that for the first time when I was, 15. And that movie is a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
You're like, there's nothing ever cooler than this ever.
Yeah, so I'm saying. That movie was cool. But anyways, that's how I'm starting the day with violence. How I ended my night last night was bliss. Jays were staring down the barrel of back-to-back games without a run. At least they had, I think, 7 hits before the Babe Schneider home run. Staring down another shutout. And I'm sitting there going, you cannot possibly be doing this again. Not after Berríos just spun a gem. Like, one mistake pitch from Berríos. And this is what is going to happen here?
It had the 2023 feel so hard.
They had made multiple mistakes that were fringy. Like, the Bo decision to go home. Like, fine, it's 2 outs, but you still got punched out. Davis Schneider, it's a tricky part of the outfield, all right, fine. Like, a bunch of those, right? All right, Kirk, the runner advances, the catcher interference. It's like, this is fine. There was one. Oh, Vladdy missing a ball.
Yeah.
That
was a weird game.
Actually, I looked at the box score, though, and it did look like they removed it as an error. I don't know what happened there. Maybe they just didn't put it up as an error. But either way, they made these kind of like bumbling mistakes that were sort of not mistakes, and it felt very Blue Jays, and I went, and they're not getting any hits. They're not getting any runs, because Justin Turner got a bunch of hits. Every time he got up to the plate, he was like, hit. And then everyone else was like, no. And it was traumatic. It was traumatic. And I know that there's the weirdos out there that are like, it's April 3rd. Don't complain. Don't say any takes. But I got a job to do. And I'm also telling you how I feel, which is like last year just bled over immediately into this season. And it just doesn't feel as though there's been any separation of the two. And Davis Schneider comes up and he hits just a massive home run, you know, like mistake pitched by Josh Hader, hangs a slider middle, to a guy that has been struggling hitting fastballs, which was a little curious that he decided to go with that. And Schneider punishes him, which is excellent, which is exactly what they needed, right? Is God, they need guys who, that was the mantra, do damage on what you can do damage on. And that's what Davis Schneider did yesterday. So kudos to him. Awesome for him. But the relief that you felt in that game is too much for a game 6 of a MLB season. And like I said, that feeling of 1 year blending over into the next, to me, is very real. To me, is a real thing. And my point of curiosity is going to be, do the players feel that too? Because it's a lot of the same guys. And there's a couple of dudes who made the team out of camp that weren't there last year, but that did finish the team, like the Davis Schneiders of the world. But this team is almost exactly the same as it was a year ago. And I talked to Brandon Belt last week, and he mentioned that they were feeling that energy in the Rogers Center down the stretch. Okay, so if you felt that energy in the Rogers Center down the stretch, you're going to feel that when you come home to start a season during a time that's mostly optimistic, where you usually do have this incredible leash where we've been scolded into hearing it's early, it's early, it's early so much that no one really even has an opinion on a baseball team for 2 months? Or are you going to show up here and feel that immediately on Monday? And how are these next four games, again, one against the Astros and three against the Yankees, going to actually change some of that or determine some of that? I'm going to ask Caleb Joseph later, but first, one of my favorites, Jeff Merrick. Jeff Merrick Podcast, 32 Thoughts. You know who he is. What's up, brother? How are we doing?
How should I feel about the Jays? Because right now, not good.
Yeah. Hey, guess what? You didn't, I don't think you did a lot of prep. You dialed in. Here's the way I would put it. It's fine. There's a lot of season to go. No,
yeah.
It shouldn't feel desperate early, and it does. You know, it's a weird spot.
Whether it's like any sport, when you have an off season like that, the start becomes so crucial.
Yeah.
Like when you look at, like, I'll just bring it into sort of, you know, my territory here with hockey, and you'll focus on the Maple Leafs. Had a lot of different faces. So you wanted to have a wait and see approach about the start of the season. But when you have a season of inactivity, when there are no real profound changes at all, other than maybe losing one of the best gloves we've seen at third base, I think you need an excellent start. And I think you deserve the criticism if you get it.
Correct.
I don't think you have the luxury of saying, like, hold on, it's a long season, about 162 games, blah, 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 blah. No.
Yeah.
When you do that in the offseason, you will face it. You will face the torches at the castle gate from opening day.
Correct.
And I think that's fine.
I think so too. And this is the thing that drives me crazy about all this stuff is people talking about the team is always a good thing, you know? Like, even like, you want to be someone that is driving passion, and I think it really does show how passionate this fan base is and how desperate they are for a winner.
Totally.
But the second part, here's my number one prediction, and I know this will come true, just like it has with those Leafs off seasons you're talking about, where they don't do much and they don't trade a core four guy after all the hand-wringing consternation, is that once you get into, like, the second month of the season, people are like, oh, yeah, the season's pretty long. We got to chill out. You're like, yeah, that's how it is. And then everybody chills out. They're like, fire Sheldon Keefe, he lost to the Ducks. And then all of a sudden you play a bunch of games, and then they're like, yeah, I guess not. Let him coach, I guess. He's fine. That's how it goes.
No, fine. Yeah, fine. I guess free living's got to keep that bullet in his chamber. Okay,
yeah,
fine.
Exactly.
Well, move along.
Exactly.
Move along.
But I love the moments of frustration and boiling over. I think that's honestly, that's one of the fun things about being a sports fan. And this is the thing I try to tell people is, yeah, it kind of is supposed to be a little therapeutic. You're supposed to get out some of the rage and angst and anger in sports. It's not always supposed to be just all celebratory. That the release is a good thing. You're not supposed to, you know, yell at your kids, or maybe you do, because if I had kids, I yell at them all the time. I can't imagine any reality where I wouldn't. But yeah, it's supposed to be a healthy place where you can release a little angst and frustration, and then you, at the end of it, you go, oh, right, that didn't matter. It's just millionaires playing a kid's game, and then you move on. Like, that's what it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be too overly serious, but I digress.
You know what? I've had so many arguments with specifically program directors about this one point, and that is this. You know what one of the great things about sports is? Hating sports.
Yes, agree.
One of the great things about sports is hating sports.
Oh, it's maybe the best.
And it's so helpful and cleansing and good. Like, I'll sort of draw this analogy.
Yeah.
I don't think that fans not showing up is as bad as one other thing, and that is buying a ticket and then not showing up. That's when you're in trouble. That's when you're really in trouble. That's where everyone's really checked out. If they're not buying tickets to begin with, okay, you can still get them. But when you make the decision to spend your money and then choose not to go, that is always the sign of trouble. And that is, I have no problem with healthy sports outrage. I think it's good. I think it's cleansing. I think it's therapeutic. I mean, I think it's part of the roller coaster of an entire season. It's just that, you know, for the Blue Jays purposes, they're getting it early and they should have expected it. If they didn't come out of the gate hot, they have to know this is coming. And the worst thing you can do, the worst thing you can do to a Blue Jays fan right now is say, it's a long season.
Yeah.
That's kind of akin of saying to someone when you're having an argument,
I know.
You need to calm down.
You need to relax. Yeah.
No, I don't.
Oh, good.
I'm so invested. Yeah. There will be no relaxing.
Yeah. No, that horrible advice, the commonplace advice, you need to relax, is the worst. That's as bad as it gets. Right?
Yeah,
that is as bad as it gets. You're mad about something? Don't think about it. Oh, thank you. Don't think about it? Why didn't I think about don't think about it? Duh. I should have just been sitting here not thinking about it, and everything would have been rainbows. No, I can't stand that. To me, it's okay. I've always had this thing about hockey where I'm going, I like skill, and I like skill training, and I like a lot of the wow plays that we have in the league now. Some of the direction that the sport needed to take in terms of being more aware of concussions and players' health and safety is great, but I've thought that hockey can never survive as a skill league alone. It has to be skill mixed with physicality, right? That's what makes the game beautiful. That's what makes it wonderful and special, and it's the same way with sports fandom is... There's a lot of people right now that are kind of pushing this idea of be positive, be positive, be positive. I'm like, that's not what it really is to be a sports fan. It is a little bit more negative because guess what? You lose more championships than you win. Everybody, even you could be a Boston, Boston sports fan that's at all the championships, right? We look at them and we're like, oh, if we could only be them. They haven't won more than they've lost, right? Like they still lose more seasons than they win. The fan frustration you absolutely need because it does drive passion, it does drive conversation, and it's the only way for the economic model to work. And so everybody that preaches the like positively only stuff should shut up because you're like conclusively wrong. It's not an opinion. You're dead wrong. It's not a thing.
Hang on. One follow-up point on that one. You cannot have one without the other.
Correct.
You cannot have jubilation without anger.
Yeah.
You cannot have sun without dark. This is, this takes you back to University 101 Chinese philosophy. It's what the Taoists talk about. These two things are not different. Mm-hmm. They are similar.
Yes.
They are joined and they arise mutually.
Yeah.
They happen at this. They are loggerheads. They are one end of a log and the other end of the log.
Yeah.
But it's still that same log. The anger, the frustration, and the joy and the exuberance, they are all part of the same thing, and you cannot have one without the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm trying to do a pivot here to my question for you, which is like,
okay,
one without the other. It's like, okay, can you give someone the Rocket Richard trophy without giving him the Selkie when he's putting together the season that he's having?
You're talking about Austin Matthews.
Correct.
So the Selke conversation is an interesting one for Austin Matthews. He is, I don't think that he's, there are two leaders so far.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we're getting to the end here. So one of them is Alexander Barkov, who will probably end up winning this thing, and rightfully so.
I was going to say, and I hate to say it, but it's probably right.
It's true. Like he's going to win this thing and probably should.
Yeah.
The other is Jordan Staal of the Carolina Hurricanes. Now there's a couple of Carolina Hurricanes, and I think this speaks a lot to the way that they play. I think you can make a case for Teuvo Teravainen as well. You might be able to make a case as well for Seth Jarvis on this team for the Selke. One of the things that's going to hold Austin Matthews back is the fact that he doesn't kill a lot of penalties.
Okay.
And generally, your Selke trophy players are the ones that are out there killing penalties. And I know we can dovetail that discussion to Mitch Marner, and certainly true. And he does kill a lot of penalties, really good at that. The problem, and specifically to start the season, 5-on-5, the defensive metrics really weren't great for Mitch Marner. And we all know that, the Selke trophy, like it or not, and I've railed against it for years, but I do grudgingly admit, this is a trophy for centers, because centers have more responsibility, specifically defensively,
100%.
than wingers do. I've always groused about how, Marian Hossa should have had a Selke along the way. Mark Stone should have a Selke by now. But Matthews does play the right position. Defensively, he's a whole lot better than he's ever been. But of available ice time for killing penalties, he's around 16%, where generally you're looking for the other guys that are going to be top of the Selke conversation, somewhere around 30.
Yeah.
So he's in the conversation. He's just not tops of the conversation. Right now, that's Barkov and Staal.
Okay.
Barkov and Staal are 1-2.
So here's where I'm at with this. One is the winger stuff is, I don't know why we need that. Like the last guy to win it was in 2003. It was Yuri Lehtinen.
Yeah.
We've decided this. Okay. It's done. It's
but
like,
hang on. Yeah. Pause for 1 second. You know what the weird thing about it is? You know why this, trophy was created?
For, yeah, a winger.
A winger. Bob Gainey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, we got to give him something. Well, okay. Let's make up a trophy. Best defensive forward. There it is. Done.
Yes.
Created for a winger. Now we only give it to centers.
Yeah. I have no rebuttal to that. This is a good point. This is a really good point. I'm like, I don't know what else to say, but hey, actually, you know what I have? Here's my rebuttal, which is always a simplistic move. It was a different time.
it was a different era. Well, last time I checked, responsibilities for Jeff, the positions were more similar than different.
Jeff, it was a different time. Okay, let's move on. This is my thing. Should Barkov win? Yeah, his team has been the best defensive team in hockey, and he's their best defensive player, and he's a center, and he does all the things. Here's my two kind of – let me outline my Matthews case simply. You look at his expected goals 5-on-5 when he's on the ice versus the rest of the team when he's off of it, and there's a pretty – there's a fairly stark difference. You look at his line and his responsibilities of this team and from the rest of the group, like, would you say that the Florida Panthers have a better defensive unit built overall or the Toronto Maple Leafs, who've been, like, playing without guys all season long and a ragtag group of defenders where guys have, like, what has been the major conversation around the Leafs forwards this year? Oh, you can't play that guy here because he's too much of a liability defensively, right? Matthews, this season, when you're looking at just some of the stats, and this one was tweeted out by Mike Kelly the other day, he's sixth in the league with 223 puck battles won, which is a stat that I feel like is a little subjective, but he's third in takeaways. And by the way, he's third behind two guys in takeaways. And David Amber pointed this one out, and I went and I had to look at it, and I was like, okay, but how is he? Where is he? And how does that stat work? Barzal is first in takeaways. Draisaitl is second. Those two guys are a combined six takeaways above Matthews. So it's like two, Barzal 79, Matthews 77, Barzal 81. Barzal has 80 giveaways. Draisaitl has 78 giveaways. Matthews has 52 giveaways. And this has all been playing in more minutes. You look at his three penalty minutes all season long, what the Leafs would be defensively without him. And I actually just think that he needs to be closer in the conversation to who Barkov is, where it's like people talk about Barkov in these just, you know, beautiful ways. Like, this guy is the consummate two-way center. And I think that people need to discuss Matthews more in that regard, but we have trouble doing it because he's so prolific as a goal scorer that it's harder to connect the two. And the penalty killing thing. And I'm like, so if Sheldon Keefe just put him on the penalty kill for a couple months this season, like, things would be different? Is that really what we're talking about here, or is there something else? Like, is there something outside of the penalty killing that you think separates these two guys in terms of the ways we speak about them?
No, the main thing is the penalty killing. To the point about takeaways, though, I've always been warned by people who work in analytics departments in the NHL, take the takeaway stat with a grain of salt when it comes to the Selke. Sort of philosophically, you know, stripping a puck, is that more important or more valuable than just being able to hold on to the puck? Like, you're right, and the Florida Panthers absolutely better defensive posture than the Toronto Maple Leafs have had, and a lot of, you know, great defensive support players. Yeah. Like, look, I'll tell you what, here's another name. here's another name that we should consider for the Selke as well. And he's a winger, so he won't get it. And you can say, well, maybe he a product of Alexander Barkov, and that's Reinhardt. Mm. Like, Reinhardt's numbers are right there as well. Now, is he a byproduct of what we see with Alexander Barkov? Yes, but he does kill a lot of penalties as well. Scored shorthanded goals, is a good special teams player, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of the one issue that I've always had with the Selke trophy is I think we all need to finally come to some type of conclusion about what qualifies you as a Selke trophy candidate. Is it just the forward who plays well defensively, regardless of any offensive output, or are we just voting for a two-way player who you have a certain amount of points that you get, plus you have a good defensive posture at the same time?
Okay, but if it's the latter, it's Matthews. He should be the guy then.
And Barkov, though.
But Matthews is a better goal scorer. He's a bit more offensive. Like, he's a more gifted player. If you were saying who's the best two-way player in the league, then it has to be him.
So then the argument then becomes, is Austin Matthews better served than just playing even strength and power play as far as deployment goes? Because I think the one place where he's going to get he has a case, but others will get more consideration is because when it's penalty kill time, he's not out there as much as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 60, I think it's like the number is 16% of available time for Austin Matthews. That's where he's going to fall down. Like all these other things you're talking about, absolutely. But I think in a lot of ways, when we talk about Matthews and want to talk about the Selke, we actually end up talking ourselves into the fact that, yeah, you know what? He should really stick to even strength and power play.
Yeah. But that's because he's so good at those two things and they need him for those two things. I guess where I'm at with this is I'm fine with it being Barkov. But if you're asking me watching the two players, I don't think that there's as big a separation between the two as there is narratively. And granted, I'm not watching as many Florida Panthers games as, you know, someone like you is, or a lot of the voters.
Really,
I know
he's really
great.
Good.
No, he's amazing.
He's really good.
He's an incredible player. And I think that, like, here's how far I would take it. I actually think that there's a case based on, like, the salary cap numbers of, like, what a guy makes. As great as Matthews has been this season, as unreal this year is, you look at the difference in the price of the two guys, and I think you would go, well, you know, you'd probably take Barkov in a draft over Matthews, just if you include the contracts, because he's that good of a player on that type of, you know, a deal. So I'm not trying to diminish who Barkov is. I'm just saying that I think Matthews gets punished a little bit for how good he is offensively. I think he gets punished for the fact that he, in the offensive zone, is someone that his best defensive trait comes in the O-zone, where he can turn you over with his stick. And, like, who do you think in the NHL, and I mean this, in terms of a forecheck player, would you say is the most dangerous in terms of is going to strip you and make an offensive play out of it? Because I think it's Matthews. I think he is the best, like, offensive defensive forward with stick utilization in the entire NHL.
I think that's Barkov, though.
Oh, you think so? You still think that's Barkov?
I really do.
Okay,
I still think that's Barkov.
Okay.
But here's the other thing. Again, I want to go back to my original question.
Yep.
Are we talking about just the best defensive forward? Because, like, that's in the definition of what this trophy is. But we seem to want to make this the best two-way forward. That's what this thing has sort of evolved into.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're just saying, like, the best, like, pure defensive forward, mm-hmm. I'd probably give this whole thing to Jordan Staal of the Carolina Hurricanes.
Mm.
Two-way, you open it up a little bit more, and Barkov's still there. Actually, I probably might just still give it to Barkov anyway for just best defensive forward. But, you know, where I think that Austin Matthews is going to be, is going to suffer. Again, it's the same way. Here's another one for you. He's going to have a hard time, the same reason why Pavel Datsyuk had a hard time with the Selke Trophy, and that is penalty killing.
Yeah. But Datsyuk won, though. I think he got three in a row. Yeah, like that was my comp, too. That was my comp yesterday on the show when I was talking about it. It was like, he's got that Datsyuk where it's like he's as good offensively as he is defensively, and the thing that he does, because Datsyuk's thing was intercepting passes and reading the play, right? Like, that was the thing that made him so special defensively, is he would just, you know, like, it was the magic man. And I think there's a little bit of that to Matthews. But you're right, Barkov's probably now going to become new Bergeron, where he ends up with, you know, six Selkies, and he just gets it every year because he, if the definition is best defensive forward, he's probably just going to keep racking it up.
Like, you can do it. Like, Datsyuk won Selke trophies. Like, that's fine. I'm just saying, like, if you want to look at sort of like the pure voting of this thing, and I think the one area where Matthews is going to suffer is the PK, because other players spend more time out there than he does. But listen, I mean, we're really splitting hairs here. I think the underlying you know, theme of all this is Austin Matthews is evolving into a much better two-way player than we've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're past the point of, oh, you know what? You can't put him out there on the penalty kill. He's an even strength and a power play guy. I think we're well past that discussion. Just like we saw what happened with Mitch Marner. And that's why, you know, you talk about, you know, what are your expectations when you don't move anything, don't move the core forward at all, you're going to get criticized, et cetera, et cetera. You know, these players are still, like, you always look at any type of athlete in two states, right?
Mm-hmm.
The athletes exist in either a state of potentiality or actuality. And just when you think, like, okay, so we've seen the best of Austin Matthews, he's now actualized as who he's going to become, and that's it, this is the top of the mountain. All of a sudden, now there's this.
Mm-hmm.
And you say to yourself, you know what? Maybe Austin Matthews is still in the potentiality phase of his career, because now we're seeing this side of Austin Matthews, which is, quite frankly, stunning.
Yeah.
Absolutely stunning.
I think he's now entering what are going to be the peak three seasons of his career, where we're like, holy crap, he put it all together. It's just going to be health. But this will be the interesting one to me, is whether or not people diminish the defensive stuff because they say he's in Toronto and he doesn't kill penalties, or if it becomes a conversation more so of, you know what, he actually is a down ballot Selke guy, which now changes the perception so that he's actually eligible for the award in other seasons. And yeah, if you're Sheldon Keefe, maybe you do have to, they don't care about individual awards, but if they did, maybe it's like, oh, you know what, put him on the PK. By the way,
Selke's an interesting trophy because it's almost like you have to spend a couple of, it's almost like you have to earn your way into the lineup rookie.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whether it was like Nico Hischier or it took Alexander Barkov or Sean Couturier a lot of years to be part of the conversation. But once you're part of the conversation, it used to be, it's like, it's going to Patrice Bergeron and all we're doing is arguing about who's going to be the runner up.
Yeah.
Now with Bergeron gone, all of a sudden the field is wide open and all those players, and you can throw Anthony Cirelli in Tampa in this conversation, Andre Kopitar as well in Los Angeles, all of a sudden the field is open. And that's sort of where we're at right now. You have to spend a little bit of time just being part of the conversation before you sort of get royal assent and you become a law.
Yeah. I think it is weirdly a trophy that I don't care the most about. Like, I'd rather have a guy win the Hart or the Rocket Richard, but it's like, it's kind of the prestigious one, you know. It's like you should like this one because it's kind of the hipster one, you know.
Like, it's the players one. It's the one where it's like the players look and go like, yeah, that guy plays. Like, all the players that have won this thing. Like,
Taves, Bergeron, Datsyuk, Brind'Amour, Barkov, O'Reilly, Kopitar. Like, that's a sexy list of guys. That's everyone's unbelievably respected list, right?
That is game knows game. Yeah. That is like, okay, if the players voted for this, who would get it? That's them. These are their guys. Mm-hmm. Ryan O'Reilly's and the Pavel Datsyuks of the world and the Alexander Barkovs. Absolutely.
Yo, you got to go. I sent you multiple topics, one of which we are going to do one day. Hopefully soon. But I sent you, I think, four topics. We did one. So we did one. Yeah. I said this would happen.
We tend to suck up a lot of the oxygen in the room, JD. It's not exactly a secret. I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Thanks for making time, buddy.
You be good, pal.
Take care. Jeff Merrick. Jeff Merrick Show and 32 Thoughts. That's all. Okay. That's I guess, where I'm going with this, okay, is people are going to say, Homer, you're a homer. You don't watch any of the teams. Of course Toronto media would do this. Leafsnet. Leafsnet doing Leafsnet things again. Dude, classic. There's some Oilers fan right now who's just bubbling over with anger listening to that. So mad. He's got to go to the comments. He's got to say something. He's got to let it rip. He's got to let it rip. He's got to let rip Leafsnet. He's like, I knew. I did it. Hell yes. That felt good writing that out in the comments section. All I really wanted from this exercise is to be like, cool. Barkov's the guy. Fine. He kills the penalties. What is the great separator between these two players? Maybe Barkov is a little bit better at the turning over, the forecheck. He can't possibly be that much better. And okay, I get what Merrick is saying about be careful with these stats, and I am. I do not think that they're gospel, right? Like, you have a human being who is taking note of what a takeaway is and what a giveaway is. But Matthews, 77 takeaways, third in the NHL this year, again, four off the lead, 52 giveaways in comparison to 78 giveaways and 80 giveaways for the two players above him. Like, that is a pretty stark difference. And now if you go over to takeaways, again, maybe they're not as good at marking this down for Barkov, but Barkov's takeaways, 54. More than 20 less on the season than Matthews. That's a pretty significant difference, okay? So when we're talking about, like, the two guys in terms of who does what and are they able to create turnovers, well, pretty conclusively, even if you give room for error on that statistic, Matthews has been far and away better at doing it than Barkov this year. Like, he just has been. He's been way better at it. And part of that is, again, Matthews has the luxury of doing it in the offensive zone more than Barkov because Barkov plays more in the D zone. He plays more on the penalty kill. It's less of an offensive output. But I do think that Matthews gets penalized for two ways. One is that, and remember when we did the referendum on block shots? Remember when everyone went, hey, actually, block shots and hits aren't as great as you think they are because it means the other team has the puck. It means you need to be blocking the shot. It means that you're on the ice for that. Hey, if you're making a hit, it means you don't have the puck. So it's not as great of a stat as we originally thought it was. That's kind of how I feel with Matthews in terms of when he's on the ice and he's turning guys over in the offensive zone because of the area of the ice in which he is most dangerous defensively is the O zone. People kind of don't look at him as a Selkie guy in the same way where it's going to be, and he does block shots, and he does, like we said, we've gone over this, like the stats prove that he is a good defensive player too in his own end, but he doesn't get as many opportunities there because he is so dangerous offensively. And so when we look back at, like, again, the history of the league and some of the guys that have won it, before it was a center award, Fedorov would win this award. Fedorov won it twice. Yeah, he won it twice. Datsyuk won this award three times in a row. I think Matthews needs to start to be considered conclusively amongst the best centers in the NHL, because if he is that, then he should be a Selke nominee every single season. And I, you know, the part I didn't get to discuss with Jeff is, will we ever get to a place where someone can win the Selke without penalty kill minutes? Because we just look at this logically and say, well, duh, he's not going to be on the penalty kill as much because look how damaging he is 5-on-5 offensively. You need to ensure that those are his minutes. You can't give him 2 minutes a night on the PK because that's 2 minutes away from times he can score goals. He's the best at that on planet Earth. So he's just exempt from this award because of common sense forever. That seems like a bit of an unfair parameter. He's so good at scoring goals that they can't afford to use him on the PK, and thusly, he is not eligible to win the Selke ever, because I don't think Auston Matthews is going to be killing a vast majority of penalties. He's never going to be one of their core four penalty killers. Okay, so he's out. Doesn't seem quite right to me. Anyway, that was your Leaf propaganda from LeafsNet. Subscribe and review. Leave 5 stars. Do all those things. Let's take a quick break. I want to come back and... First of all, actually, this is the way I'm going to try to do a good radio tease. The worst kind of sports talk. Not me. The ones others do. Next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
I already have the Christopher Nolan fans coming at me.
Oh, do you? Nice.
Oh, yeah. I knew they would come.
I feel like they're a pretty rabid bunch.
Dude. Off air today, we were talking about who the number one like my sport fans are or like my team fans are. Like we were going through like who's the whiniest, right? Because it's like, and then trying to determine is it like my sport or is it the whiniest? It's like, hey, which ones are the worst? It's like Raptors fans. Again, if you don't think you are, it's fine. The whole world thinks you are. Literally every single NBA podcast is terrified by you and has referenced you, name checked you a billion times being like, you're a different entity. You're different than, like, Bill Simmons used to do a thing where he called Portland Trailblazers fans the soccer moms, the Portland soccer moms, because they would be, like, always complaining about everything, not enough Portland coverage. Raptors fans have completely ripped that belt from Portland and turned it into something else, where it's like, even the journaliest of the journalists, you know, have... cower in fear of what Raptors Twitter will do when you are getting submerged by the wave of look at this clown, hashtag clown, clown. When someone disagrees with a Raptors thing or calls out the Raptors. You know, because I think that, you know, sorry, but women's basketball fans, you're kind of the same way. Like, you're big time, protect the shield, and no one can say anything negative. No one can be like, oh, that's kind of critical, without it being like, oh, you're cross the line. It's like, eh, I don't know. If anybody actually did cross the line, it's kind of normal sports talk. It's not really that big of a deal. Wasn't really a thing. Christopher Nolan fans definitely get lumped in with this group where it's like, if you don't like Inception, it's like, oh, you didn't get it. You're really stupid, huh? Like, you're really a dumb idiot. Yeah, I just didn't think it was that. I was like, I get it. Yeah, no, you...
you thought 3.5 hours was too long?
Yeah. It's okay. You're too stupid to get it. But that's what I mean is so many of his movies are like that where it's, oh, you didn't like it? Dumb idiot. What was the one called with the moving backwards thing?
Oh, yeah, Tenet?
That movie stinks.
It's funny because I was reading something where even he was like, you know, honestly, if you're trying to follow the plot, don't really worry about
it. Dude, thank you. Thank you. I actually saw that same thing because I sent it to Ennis Ennis is a big, like, Christopher Nolan is he's the actual Oppenheimer of our time. The Oppenheimer is actually a commentary on him for movies.
As an auteur.
Yeah. And That's the defense of everyone. I'm like, okay, sure. Yeah, no, you get it. It's the guy that made Batman. He's so complicated. He's just a genius. It's like his best movie was literally like Batman's mad at the Joker
Batman
again.
Punches guy
he punches
in face.
He's like, where is she? That's the best thing he ever did. And he's a genius of our time.
Might be the best superhero movie ever.
Not maybe. 100%.
Dark Knight, right?
Dark Knight. Is, yeah. Like, I nothing's even close. I'm a bit of a Marvel movie hater. Like, it's just not for me, and I'm, like,
But so here's the thing that I was thinking. Yeah. Movies have a lot of the, like my thing, because the Marvel movie people are also weirdos.
No, but I think that even
it's
the Marvel
cooled
movie
a bit,
people...
But they're like, what? Like, you don't get it. And it's like, man, it's the same.
But I think the Marvel movie people have started to agree that it got oversaturated and that they started to ruin it a little bit. I will say this, though. I'm a Marvel movie hater, but Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one, rules.
Banger.
That movie is a... good movie.
Thor Ragnarok's really funny and good.
Yeah,
like,
I like that one, but that one's solid. I would say I have three Marvel movies that I respect. Like Iron Man.
Mm-hmm. First one.
Thor Ragnarok.
OG.
And that one.
Yeah.
And I think Guardians of the Galaxy is like a gap between the other ones. My opinion. I'll probably get more messages about this, by the way, at JD Bunkus, Twitter, and Instagram, than any of the sports takes I'm going to do today.
We do need Movie Corner with JD soon. I mean, let's get some movie takes out
soon. Yeah, I think Mike is a big movie guy, too.
Oh, perfect.
You do trivia? You host trivia? You have a mic? Oh, you can't hear? You didn't have your headphones in? He's like, he was just nodding. Yeah. He's like not listening like a psycho. All right, I forgot that you have to put the headphones on to hear when your mic is on. You host a movie trivia night?
Not just movies, but I do trivia. Yeah.
Okay,
Wednesday nights.
You do trivia, eh?
I have a movie podcast, though.
Okay, that's what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, wait, so you want to weigh in on Nolan?
Oh, listen, Dark Knight, great movie.
Yeah.
Not a fan. Not a fan.
See, okay, so.
I like that movie, but Christopher
Dude, we're
Nolan
starting
is,
a resistance.
Overrated.
Now,
he
now,
is overrated.
Now
he is overrated.
We're
wow,
starting,
okay.
We're starting a movement. Although I will say that this is kind of a classic dumb guy move, is to be like this is playing into the Christopher Nolan hands. It's like, because once you get good enough at something, you need your detractors.
Yeah.
People are like, you're not so hot. Like, yeah, he's probably pretty good if you're talking about him like that. <You know? laughs> He's doing something right. He's doing something all right.
The other thing that I get sometimes when I say like that some of those like really like artsy Christopher Nolan movies aren't that good is people be like, well, you don't get it. And I just have to go, yeah, kind of. I kind of don't, you know? So I guess I just have to wear that one. I might be dumb. That's okay.
Yeah. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I actually think that I was talking about this with Ennis on the phone the other day. I think my entire appeal with this is that I'm just like very basic.
Yeah.
It's that I'm just
a guy.
I'm just the most basic guy. Like everything about me is just like, where is he on that? He's the most basic. Yeah. He's going to give you like some people are afraid because AI is going to be able to scrape all their data and be able to replicate them. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, you're just going to replicate like what everybody could do. Should have just replicate the most basic guy. Good job by you. Actually, maybe that's the most terrorizing thing that they could actually accomplish. Okay, so I teased it. I said that there is a sports discussion that drives me, I almost swore, because that's how mad it makes me. Drives me, you know what, insane. I can't stand it. And it came with the discourse of Joel Embiid returning to the NBA. Last night, Joel Embiid returns. And it was pretty surprising because there hadn't been a lot of buzz about, hey, tomorrow, or the next day. It's like, this is a guy who just won. This is the MVP of the league from last year. So one of the six most important players in the NBA returning to a team that has championship aspirations, and it kind of flew a little under the radar. And again, local radar here, because I'm sure in Philly it was the top story, right? Everybody was talking about it, but here we're concerned with a million other things. We had a huge, huge, huge busy sports day. Jay's getting no hit. Caitlin Clark, you know, getting revenge. The Maple Leafs played on Monday against the Panthers. There's a lot going on here. But Joel Embiid flies in. He's under the radar. But how was I alerted to his return? It wasn't the 30 minutes, the 24 points, the 7 assists, and the 6 rebounds with 6 games left to play in the season. It was the overwhelming discourse that I saw online of, why is he coming back? Why is Joel Embiid coming back? I saw Gilbert Arenas do a plea for Joel Embiid not to try to, quote, prove it to anybody. This is one of my biggest pet peeves that we have in all of sports right now, is this idea that the public somehow knows better, that these athletes are being forced to play sports. This is no longer the you got your bell rung era, get back out there. This is no longer the rub some dirt in it, get back out there era. This is the advancement of basically every sport science and recovery that we've ever had. For a guy like Joel Embiid, he's got 6 games left in the regular season to get himself up into playing shape, okay? He's got 6 games left. He's got to get out there, and he's got to start getting in shape. Why? Because he played 30 minutes last night, and I watched some of it. I wasn't able to watch a lot of it, but I was trying to kind of tune into it a little. He looked winded at times. He looked like he was kind of laboring a little bit up the court. Do you know how old Joel Embiid is? You guys want to guess? Don't look. Guess. Like, Armin, you're actually the number one basketball fan on the show, so you better get this right, because this is the sport you're supposed to know. How old is Joel Embiid?
I'd go 27.
He's 30.
What?
Yeah, correct. Correct! Joel Embiid is 30 years old. Okay? How many years of Joel Embiid do you think that we're getting based on the injury history, the way he runs, the age, the minute log, the responsibility log? Like, you think Joel Embiid is going to be playing into his 40s? You think he's going to be the next LeBron? Nah. He's not. He's not going to be the next LeBron. He's going to probably have another 4 to 5 seasons, if we're lucky. That's if we're lucky, where he's playing at a top-tier, high-event, elite level. A little bit of this, I will say, I understand that people look at it and go, feels like Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant came back early. Kevin Durant came back early because he wanted to win a NBA championship. He already had some. Who cares? That was the stakes for him. He decided, yep, you know what? It's a little rushed, but the juice is worth the squeeze, because what I'm trying to do is accomplish the greatest height in the sport, which is win a championship. And Joel Embiid is trying to do the same thing, clearly. Obviously, this is through the consultation of the medical team. Obviously, the Sixers have probably poured every single resource into this thing and have determined that there is a level of risk that he has to accept in order to play basketball, which is fine. I get it if you're scared for Joel Embiid, if you're scared for the future of the franchise. But again, this is someone who is 30 years old, who knows how many years am I going to have left at a high-end elite level in my sport. I've got 6 games left to try to get up into game shape, which is not going to be enough. But then we're going to have to get him in a first round that's going to end up being a battle. And guess what? If they get bounced, he'll have all the time to rest and recuperate, hopefully. And then maybe he'll get right for the Olympics. My actual hope, sneakily, is that not that he gets hurt, but that this injury has caused him to reevaluate going to the Olympics. Mm. That he has gone, yeah, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't go. Maybe Olympics is too much miles on the tires, and USA basketball is going to have to deal without me. And then Canada soars past them. The elderly USA basketball team, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander and Jamal Murray, absolutely cook the dinosaur USA team.
I like this.
And Zach Edey is like, no one can guard me. Yeah, exactly. No one can guard me. I'm flushing it. But yeah, I think we get way too precious with this stuff. I think we get far too precious with athletes who are returning from injury, especially athletes with injury history or who are big, right? Like, because let's be honest, if this is happening to a point guard, I don't think it's the same, right?
Right.
If this is happening to Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, if there's 6 games left in the regular season and Shea is coming back for the Thunder, or Anthony Edwards is coming back for the T-Wolves, I don't think anybody's doing this. They're doing this because it's Joel Embiid, and we're like, save the career, save the career, save the career. Save the career for what? He gets hurt all the time. Like, save the career for what? What is he saving it for? They've used multiple different ways of trying to keep this guy healthy, and he ends up usually getting hurt. His team is in the playoffs in a year where the Eastern Conference is probably weaker than it's ever going to be. Like, he's still a matchup nightmare for the Boston Celtics. Like, you think Kristaps Porzingis is really going to slow him down? No, he's going to eat him alive. Yeah, I'm sorry, Simon. Sorry to do that. The Latvian guy is having a great year, but he's getting torched by Joel Embiid. He's going to dominate him. You think that Brook Lopez is going to slow him down? You think Giannis? No, he's going to be able to get his. He's going to eat. And if Joel Embiid can give you 35 minutes in a playoff game, which I think that's kind of what you're hoping for, is like 33, 34 minutes, because they're not going to play him into the ground. Like, they're not going to play him into the dirt. But if you can get those minutes from Joel Embiid, you got to take them. And again, this is done at the behest of the player. My doubt, and prove me wrong then, someone go write the, get Wright Thompson on the case. Oh, actually, more, he's more of a features writer, but get like, who always breaks stuff for, who cares? Get Shams. Get Shams. Get somebody to go deep dive and tell me that the Philadelphia 76ers are being reckless with Joel Embiid's career and that they're rushing him and that they're pressuring him. Like, if we get those stories, then fine. Let's have Gilbert Arenas and let's have all these other people that are so terrified of this guy, you know, stepping on the basketball court. Give us some actual evidence as to why they don't want to see one of the best players in the sport, who is 30 years old, working with a team that very much has a shelf life, why he shouldn't play. That's all I want to know. Why this guy shouldn't be competing for championships, what it is exactly that he's waiting for. And by the way, the one good thing I will say about Embiid from yesterday is watching him, he did look winded at times, but he never looked like he was walking with a weird gait. He never looked like he was still dealing with something, or there was, this guy's coming back and he's still playing hurt, or this looks rushed. Like, looked fluid, just looked tired. Just looked like a 7-footer who probably hasn't spent a lot of time on his legs. And there was also a cool moment in that game where he dapped up Allen Iverson, and I went, yeah, Allen Iverson, he didn't want to practice, but he wanted to show up for the games. So anyway, stop being so nervous about this. And I really hope Joel Embiid stays healthy, because I really, like, now that he's not competing with the Raptors for championships, now that the Raptors have been like, we're good, we're out. Worry about which 7-foot guy that you're going to take in the draft. I like Joel Embiid. I'm a fan of Joel Embiid. I think he's good for the NBA. He's an enjoyable watch. Nobody wants to see him get hurt. Of course, nobody wants to see him get hurt. But I especially don't want to see him get hurt, because not only are we going to lose one of the game's greatest players, but we're going to end up with a billion people who are going to act as though they have medical degrees and say, I told you so.
Yeah, there are already a lot of those, like, online, especially in, like, fantasy football or whatever. Yeah.
No, it happens all the time. Dunkers. It happens with all sports. It's like, this guy shouldn't return yet. It's like, based on what?
Yeah.
Like, based
the
on
argument
what?
Is, I think the generic argument is that the Sixers don't have a chance to compete for a championship. I'm not saying I agree.
Yeah.
But I think that's what people are pushing. It's like, what are you coming back for, really?
So question for you guys, and this is like, you know, there are a bunch of basketball fans here. Like, the Sixers with Embiid this year are still 28-6. Like, and great, like, that would be a 765 win percentage. That would be the second best win percentage
NBA, right?
In the league. Like, are they a threat in the East at all?
Hey, Simon, were you at a cottage drinking this weekend? Like, nobody can tell. did you have a happy Easter? Like, Simon, literally three words. Do you guys think it's like just laboring? So,
we haven't even seen Buddy Hield play with Embiid yet. So,
dude, this is the most defeatist, crazy approach to all of this. Like, do you think, so what? Like, so your opinion is what, the Orlando Magic should start sitting guys? Because they're like, well, what's even the point? They shouldn't even go out there and play, because that's just a risk to these players. Like, where's the line between the experience or the long shot versus what we have with Embiid? Like, it's crazy to me that this is the position people take. If you told me that you're getting the three teams in the Eastern Conference with the best shot when they're healthy, the Sixers are the third.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, what are we doing here? What are we doing here if this is where we've gotten with the NBA and with professional sports? But I think this is far more an NBA issue than it is with anything else.
I agree, definitely.
It's like, what are we doing here if what the MVP from last year, like the most valuable player, you don't think they can win if he's playing in basketball games? Like, this is a sport where the MVP wins championships all the time.
Well, that's why it's different in the NBA, because one player can make such a big difference. So they're saying if he gets re-injured, the Sixers, like, next season is done.
Yeah.
It's not the same in the other leagues.
Guess what? Everybody else, you get injured, you're done too. Yeah, it is the same in other leagues. Your quarterback gets injured, you're out. You're done. Like, you are. The Leafs lose Austin Matthews. Guess what? They're probably not winning the Stanley Cup. Guess what? The Oilers lose Connor McDavid. For the last MVP, guess who ain't winning the Stanley Cup? The Edmonton Oilers. I actually hate that with the NBA, where they're like, oh, well, if this happens, it's like, no. Actually, that's all sports. That's not just you. That's not your thing, is that the best players win, okay? I've done this. I've said this a million times, but in the NHL, Stanley Cup champion has all, like, every single one of the greatest players has won. The greatest guys who didn't were Marcel Dion and Eric Lindros, okay? So, no. Historically, the greats win in all sports. It's not exclusive to the NBA. We just think it is, because that's the way that we market it more, is around the stars than the other leagues.
Joel Embiid, you don't agree one player in the NBA makes more of a difference
than what?
Than one player in any of the
than
other
a quarterback?
Sports. Besides a quarterback, I agree with you there. Okay. Besides a quarterback.
Well, they play more minutes and they touch the ball more. So, yeah, obviously they impact the game more. I'm saying that ultimately you lose your best player on any team to an injury, you're reckless with someone who is by far and away your most valuable player, it drastically diminishes your chances of winning. Like, sure, more important is subjective. This idea of you lose your best player in hockey and you'll be fine is not. Like, that's not a thing. I think Embiid probably... Embiid is involved in this. This is the player empowerment era. To tie this up in a knot or a bow, whatever. Embiid has all the information in front of him. The Sixers have presented him with everything. This is not going to be a shady situation where they have duped him into returning. He has accepted the risk, and the risk is such that it actually should make sense to most sports fans that he's a 30-year-old player who's had trouble staying healthy, that has been able to get healthy enough for the playoff run on a team that actually does have not a front-runner chance, but an outside chance at winning an NBA championship. And if you really care about sports and you care about athletes and you care about the greats, you should want to see those guys play. You should want to see athletes accept that risk. You shouldn't want to live in a reality where it's the other way around, where guys are always basically punting on seasons with the hope of someday being in the perfect physical health in order to finally push themselves to try to achieve those goals. That is part of sports. Sacrificing the body, I'm sorry, is part of sports. That's why you get paid millions of dollars and get to pay, live like a celebrity to do such. You're not working in a coal mine making basically nothing and assuming even greater risk. Anyways, let's take a quick break. Let's come back. Let's talk to Caleb Joseph about last night. I've always joked with my core Blue Jays fans buddies that the beginning of the season is always the most intense until you get to basically September, late August, September, and you're battling for a division, right? Or a playoff seedings, playoff spots. But right now is the time of the year where the games do feel the most important because the team has been gone and like set the tone. 2 months from now, people are going to chill out. People are going to be reminded that, oh yeah, the season's long. And a lot of the takes that we had earlier on have evaporated. That the discussions we're having now are wildly different, whether it's, you know, injuries or positive regression or the fact that we need a lot of ABs and a lot of innings from a lot of these players or from all of these players before we can actually kind of formulate something concrete. That'll come. But right now, even with that in mind, even with that idea of, all right, it's fun at the beginning of the year and the takes start flying around, this does feel more intense. This feels even more intense. If you're a Blue Jays fan, like a diehard, you'll remember that after the 2015 exit, 2016, they come back and they play the Rays. And there was a series. It was the first year where they removed the like sliding through the base stuff where they were like, hey, no more of this. No more of these shenanigans. We don't want guys to get hurt. Soft, in my opinion. Caleb just probably disagrees, but I saw it happen the other day where there was a little skirmish at second base where someone slid through the bag and they were like, oh, we got his cleats up, boo-hoo, and everyone's crying. I like that stuff. But they do that and they call, I think it was Bautista out, and the Jays lose on review. And like I was at a sports bar for it and the bar went nuts and people were like losing their minds. And it was because we were still attached to the 2015 exit. And so it felt like a playoff game watching the very first series against the Rays at the Trop. This feels even more intense than that. Like this feels right now like they are carrying around the millstone of last season, the millstone of what they could not accomplish at the plate around their necks. And that's for fans. That's for fans. But I am curious if our next guest thinks that it might even be the same for the players. Caleb Joseph, a guy who actually played, Blue Jay studio analyst. What's up, brother? How are we doing?
Hey, great. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I don't know how much of that you heard. But do you think that...
All of it.
Okay, perfect. Good. And you're like, you said that almost like, they could have called me a little later.
No. All good. That was good.
So what do you think about... So I had Brandon Belt on last Friday, and I asked him about how he was feeling down the stretch of last season, right? Those games in Texas. And he admitted that he felt the fan frustration in the Rogers Center, that it was something that like, yeah, you couldn't escape. You couldn't escape the feeling of it. How do you think these guys, because like there's been basically no turnover to the roster. The one guy that is brand new, Justin Turner, was raking yesterday. He seemed completely unbothered. But do you think that there is a carryover for some of these players? Like, how are you perceiving the way that these guys have tried to turn the page from last season's frustrations into this one?
Yeah, I definitely feel that they understand the weight of what's going on. That you look at their defense, it was a very well performing last year. You look at their pitching, the starting pitching, the relief pitching. a lot is the same. And everybody knows what's the separating factor. Well, it's going to be the offense. And that's primarily what the general managers have talked about going into this season is we believe in our core. They're talking about we believe in the offensive capabilities of our core, not we believe that our core offensive players are going to turn into Cy Young and start pitching for us. And no, they know that. They know going into it that it's about picking it up on offense. And so you can feel it. I was down in spring training a couple weeks ago, and you could just feel kind of the intensity of the weight at hand. It was very businesslike, and you can already see it in the first couple of games. You could see the looseness that they can play with when they do start firing on all cylinders. And then you can also see the tightness that can happen very, very quickly when you have a pitcher on the other side that's doing what he gets paid to do and locating and changing speeds. And I feel like it might be a bit of a up and down. I feel like this could be an early indicator of what this summer might look like for this squad. It could look very, very appealing, and it could look very, very unappealing in a matter of 24 hours.
Yeah, it just feels tense, man. Like, it feels tense from the fan base standpoint anyways. And I guess I'm fan and media, but I think that it's even a little tense with the media. And I just imagine that, you know, coming into spring, one of the things I love about baseball is this is supposed to be the season where you do the anything can happen, right? Like, I've remembered Blue Jays teams that had absolutely zero chance, like the 2017 and 2018 teams. 2018 more so, because at least 2017, they were kind of halfway being like, no, we're still competing. And then 2018, sure, though, opening day was like, yeah, this team is not good. They're not doing much. But even that day, I was like, well, here's how it could happen, right? You dream on stuff like that. It's a super optimistic time. And I would imagine that's got to be that way for the same thing with the players, right? Is that you come into the season going, man, I'm going to have a hell of a year. And these are the things I've been working on. And this is the stuff that I want to accomplish. And these are my goals. And this is all the training that I've put in. And I guess what I'm driving at here is I'm a little nervous that some of these guys, like that looseness that you see when things are going well, that the converse stuff, the tightness when things are going poorly, that is extending to them in their at-bats. Like, are you seeing that at the dish right now? Like, guys falling into bad habits? Like, again, it's six games, so I know I'm asking you for such a tiny sample, sure, but do you think that part, sure, of what we're seeing right now is a bit of tightness?
Yeah, so much of baseball is confidence. Mm-hmm. And somebody might say, how in the world are you supposed to have confidence, especially hitting-wise, when you might only have a 28% success rate? And that's the challenge. The challenge, mm-hmm, is when you're in spring training, when you're working on these things, when you're implementing the stuff that you spent 4 months working on in the offseason, when it doesn't matter, every line drive in the cage is a double in the left field gap, and you're feeling super confident. It's how do you translate that into a game-like scenario where you start the grind of a season, and even spring training can go well, and things just change. The regular season is totally different than spring training, which is why spring training can be the biggest fooler sometimes. It can also give a decent indication, but it can be a fooler. And I've had it where I thought I was in a really good spot in spring training. The season started, and then out of nowhere, I felt like I had taken 15 steps backwards. I've been there before, and I've also had spring trainings where I felt like I was really good and then ended up having a good, solid first 3 months of the season. Mm-hmm. It's more a matter of just confidence, and I think inside of your preparation and inside of your routine, that's how you can kind of gain that confidence. If you're result oriented, especially early on, you're going to look at that scoreboard first 2 weeks of the season, and your batting average is going to be like a heart monitor because you've only got like 10 at bats, right? Mm-hmm. So you can get two hits and you can go up to 600 batting average and you feel like you're Babe Ruth. And then 2 days later, you take 0-for-8. And you're hitting 167, yeah, and it can get really, and I know a lot of people don't really pay attention to batting average, but trust me, players still look at it. They still look at it. So it's just a matter of finding ways to get confident. And for me, that is through your routine and through your preparation, knowing that you're doing the same thing, mm-hmm, and the results will follow. But yeah, you can feel it. I mean, you can see it. Guys start gripping the bat a little bit more tense, and you can see it on TV for sure.
Dude, so this is what I want to try. And the the batting average stuff is so real. Now, I will say I do it a little bit more with just OPS because they'll put that up on the like the big screen at the Rogers Center, right? When you're at the ball game and you look at the lineups, what's the first thing you look at? It's the OPS, right? I think every fan does that now. You look down and you see the OPS and you go, okay, well, that's the soft spot in the lineup. And, oh, wow, this guy's really doing damage this year. And I just can't imagine that a player who's doing the dish doesn't see that massive screen when they come up and their numbers pop in there. Doesn't sometimes, not every time, but doesn't have the odd moment where they look at it and they're like, damn, I gotta get that going,
yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And that's why I really feel part of this opening stretch. I'm so glad that you touched on that. And I've said this opening couple of weeks is more important for the Jays than any team in baseball because they do have that carryover, because the fan base is frustrated. They do want to see some of those differences. But I think, like, man, so I don't like using them. I feel like I'm piling on here, but I don't want to use this as, like, I'm not trying to do that. But if you're Dalton Varsho and you come home and your first game back at the Rogers Center and they pop that visual up and your OPS right now is 368, even though it's only six games, it can't feel good when you left last season as the whipping boy for a bad trade. You know what I'm saying? So it's like those guys, you want to feel hot, you want to feel good. And I think this is going to be kind of like an important game for the, or four games for the bats to get going just for the, I don't know, let's call it the big screen effect that we need here. The big screen effect for opening day, for home opener.
Yeah, you're right. I've been so impressed really with the fan base and their passion for this team. And I came to Toronto as a visiting player many, many times, and you could feel the passion was there. But getting to know these fans on a more personal level, you can really feel it. And it's a good thing. And as a player, you want to be in that position where your fans expect you to win. You don't want to play for other organizations, say maybe Pittsburgh, where you might only have 4,000 fans any given night that care, but not like an entire nation does. And so it's an honor to feel that type of pressure. At the end of the day, this is what you get paid to do. You get paid to perform. This is a what have you done for me lately league. And the expectations on this team are not to win, but to go deep. And so that is the standard. And you know that going into it as a player, and maybe even that is as another heightened part of this deal is that they know not only are we expected to make the playoffs, we're expected to go deep. And that's great to have those expectations.
Yeah.
You just got to make sure you monitor that with what you're doing every single day. Cause if you start getting caught up in the 5 weeks, 5 days, 5 months from now, you will blink and you will not like what you see on the screen. But yeah, it would help to come into Rogers Center for the first game and have your numbers exactly where you want.
Yeah.
Hear that big roar from the crowd.
Yeah.
And you want optimism versus pessimism.
Big
and
time.
I totally get it from a fan's perspective. I totally get it.
100%. Okay. So you said it. One of the things they gambled on the court, right? They're like, okay, we're gambling on the same guys and everybody's coming back. And one of them is positive regression offensively from the start. So they all know this. But the other thing that they've been searching for this entire time, and what I think actually really added to the frustration of last season wasn't even just the offense. It was, hey, we sacrificed Teoscar Hernandez and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. And we took some of that out because we were looking for a more mature baseball team, right? It was, we want to grow up. And then they're playing in this series against the Twins and they're making the same mistakes on the base paths that they've made all along. And so you as a fan go, like, okay, wait, so I don't get the home runs, but I still get the same Dumbo stuff? Like, that's not fair. Like, I don't want that. You can't suck the fun out and say they're going to be a mature team, but then they're not a mature team. Last night was a weird one because there were four plays where I went, all of these, I'm like, yeah, kind of debatable, except for, I guess, maybe Vladdy missing that one baseball. But, like, they have Schneider with a really difficult play out in center field where there's that strange part of the wall. But then I look at it and I'm like, yeah, okay, but shouldn't he kind of get it? Like, should he make a better play where it doesn't look like his hat's fallen off and he's completely lost it? You know, you get Bo with two outs where you go, all right, it's being aggressive and they need runs and it's there. But then he's kind of dead to rights and you go, okay, well, he was out by quite a bit. You know, you get the Kirk catcher's interference. You get the error that charged to Bo, but is kind of on Vladdy. Where are we at in terms of just like the mistakes yesterday? Were they mistakes? Because my Dumbo brain doesn't, I couldn't tell on really any of them definitively other than the Bo throw and then the Vladdy miss.
Yeah, and we saw that in the Tampa series as well. We saw Vladdy at first base. We saw both take a backhander and give a long hop, and Vladdy just kind of miss it.
Yeah.
It is something, that in the early part of last year, I remember not necessarily being a problem, but I do remember games like this sticking out, where it's one thing if you spread out two or three of those plays from last night over a week, you probably don't notice it. But when it starts, that when it all happens inside of one game, it gets the sense of okay, you're trying to throw this game away. And that's what I always felt as a major league player, is we were expected to play the most crisp, clean style game the entire 162. That was our best chance to win. And that's what I think that they've been preaching in Dunedin and going into spring training. We've heard it over and over and over. Take care of the little things. Take care of the controllables. You can't really control if the pitcher, say two nights ago, throws a no-hitter because he's absolutely dotting. There are certain things inside of that that you can control in terms of where you stand on the plate or how you approach it a certain pitch. But if a guy has it, a guy has it some nights. But there are controllables throughout a game. You can be in charge of your preparation. You can be in charge of your effort. You can be in charge of knowing where you are positionally on the field, all of those types of things. And there have been a couple already this season where they are giving away inches. And I always talk about the inches in a baseball game. And it's kind of like that, what's the saying with that football movie. There's inches, you know. And
it's a game of inches.
Pacino
Pacino.
I love that. And it's the same thing. It's the exact same way in baseball. And the turnover battle and trying to figure out who wins the turnover battle. So it's all these type of plays when you start listing them out. It might not go down as an actual physical error, possibly. But when you check off these lists, whoever wins that turnover battle, more times than not, is going to win the game. And so when you see games like this where it's four or five things compiled together, it does kind of raise my antennas up a little bit, because they had some issues with this last year. A lot of it has to do with a lot of guys get really engaged when they're really going well on offense. And that's the worst thing that you want to see as a manager, is guys taking their at-bats to the field. I'm not saying they're doing that, but you got to really be able to turn it off. And once you're on that field, you're a defender. Mm-hmm. Once you're on the base pass, you're a base runner. And once you're at the plate, you're a hitter. Three separate parts of the game you got to compartmentalize. But, yeah, to play a really tight, clean baseball game is what the Jays are going to have to do night in, night out. Hopefully they can do it from here on out.
I got to go watch that Pacino speech later. I got to watch that again today, because I'm like, God, that's such a good speech. I just pulled up the transcript, and it's like, it's so good. It's so good. The inches we need are everywhere around us. They're in every break of the game, every minute, every second. On this team, we fight for that inch. On this team, we tear ourselves and everyone around us for pieces of that inch. We claw with our fingernails for that inch, because we know that when we add them up, all those inches, that's going to make the bleeping difference between winning and losing, between living and dying. That's what I'm talking about. If you're the Blue Jays, you got to treat those inches like it's Pacino at the beginning of the season, okay? Like, I want to see the inches now being treated with respect. And so that was it for me yesterday. So I was like, okay, there's Farland. I was like, trying to be a little forgiving, but I also feel like I have less of a tolerance for forgiveness at the outset of a season, when, again, this has been one of the mandates for three, four, five seasons in a row. Okay, I'm going to switch to a big positive so far. Berríos looks better, and I don't have enough, again, a refined enough eye to really understand why. Does he look better to you? Like, what are you seeing with Berríos through these first two starts? Because he looks like playoff Berríos, and I mean that in a very, very positive way.
Yeah, he is so impressive. You hear GM Ross Atkins talk about him and his work ethic, and I know the type of guy he is. He's a fantastic guy, and so is everybody else in the big leagues, right? But, you know, when you start combining all of these intangibles together, and then you have a really smart, experienced veteran pitcher out there that is kind of like a fine wine getting better and better and better. That's exactly what you want to see. We saw the same thing kind of with Kevin Gausman. Is you get to a certain level and you just understand it better. And I'm not saying that he didn't understand pitching coming into this year. He absolutely understands it, but it's all about maneuverability around your out pitches, around damage, around places that you want to get to. And I just love that he has that changeup as a weapon. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a bit of a work in progress when he first got over to Toronto. Wasn't the best shape, didn't have the best speed differential. But the biggest thing that I've been able to tell is he has defense mechanisms built in now around the breaking ball that if he doesn't have that slurve, he can still survive. And that's what you want. You want to have a place to go, whether to change up, whether it's a glove side front hip two-seamer to a lefty, whether it's being able to go up top with a fastball, run a two-seam in. He has a lot of pitchability now, and that's when you see guys really start to take off, when they can locate their pitches, when they have a repeatable windup, mm-hmm. which is something that he has really, really worked on, having a really repeatable windup. And you got to give Pete Walker a ton of credit because he continues to get these guys better and better and better to a more elite level. And a lot of it is just very basic stuff, but it's really hard to teach at times. And he's gotten him to that position where he can repeat his windup. He can stay inside his lane. If he's trying to go to the outside half, he's going to miss on the correct spot. And then he has the ability to pitch around certain guys' damage zones because he now has the changeup. He can have that backdoor two-seam. He would be a catcher's dream to catch right now because he's got all the things. Stuff, mm-hmm. location, differential of speed, and competitiveness. And that's what you're looking for. And so he's presenting that really well so far early this season. I'm not surprised. He's been a very, very good pitcher for a long time in mm-hmm. this league. Hopefully he keeps it up.
Yeah, he looks phenomenal. He really does. I guess the difference for me is, and I know that this is a very simplistic way of looking at it, but I went, okay, when they got Barrios, it was, when they first got him, it was, oh, can this guy be a high-end two? And he went, all right, yeah, he was, for the most part. And then the tough season happens and expectations shift and you say, ah, can he be a good solid three? That's what you're really hoping for, right? A good, mm-hmm. solid inning eating three who puts it up. And now I'm looking at him, I'm saying, damn, he feels like Minnesota Twins Jose Barrios again, where he's right. nasty. He's a front end starter and I've got all the confidence in the world in him. And just like how much that perception has changed from, boy, this might end up being a bad contract to, oh, this guy might end up being... like, there's not an unrealistic scenario where he is the most important pitcher on the team. Like, and they have Kevin Gausman, right. who I think will be, but I'm just saying outside chance. Okay, less of an optimistic one. What'd you see from, well, maybe it's optimistic, sorry, but yeah, well, not as good of a start. What did you see in Bowden Francis's first outing? Is it cause for concern, or is this just, hey, guy got rattled in his first start against an elite offense in a tough ballpark, and there was actually a lot more good. It just wasn't results. Like, what did you think of the process?
Yeah, that's a great question. I watched that game thinking, okay, what is he going through right now? First uh-huh. major league start. That is a very, very difficult place to play. And I'm not giving him the out by any means, but that mm-hmm. I hated playing in that stadium. Hated it because those fans are crazy. The team just seems to get rolling very, very quickly. And you know, I had a manager one time say, sometimes it's not who you're playing, but when you're playing them. And I think the fact that they lost the first four games of the season, I think it could have been Kevin Gausman. It could have been Barrios. It could have been anybody. And I feel like that offense was going to do what they did just because of the timing of when you're playing a team. And I don't think that's talked about enough, that sometimes you can have decent stuff and it just matches up perfectly for what that team is going to do, has expectation to do, hasn't done in the first four games, and then just goes and gets it done. But I do. I like the breaking ball. I like it a lot. I like the fact that he has some deception on that fastball. He's a massive human. He is a huge guy. And he's got a unique delay in his release, which throws off a little bit of that timing. You can see 94, 95, but a lot of times guys are going to be late on that pitch just because of the deception. Mm-hmm. I thought Buck touched on it really, really well, that when you locate, you are going to have success. And you saw that when he actually got the ball to the position, he had a lot of success. It is a little bit harder to basically be a two-pitch guy as a starter. As you see Kevin Gausman, you better have a really elite secondary pitch and a pretty elite fastball to get away with it. I think the development of that split is going to really help him out. But more than that, I do believe that getting the pitch where you need to is the biggest separator between AAA and the big leagues. You can get away with mistakes left and right in AAA if you have major league stuff, just because the hitters are not that good. But the difference between AAA and the big leagues in terms of offensive capabilities, night and day, and you have got to be really fine. You've got to miss in the right spot. And I just felt like some of his misses in that Houston game were not in the right spot. And he caught a team that was about to go off, and it was kind of a bit of a perfect storm. But I do like his stuff.
Yeah.
I do think he profiles as a guy who can eat some innings.
Yeah.
I don't really know. Try not to be rude, but I'm not as concerned with that five spot as I am the first four. But I do think Bowden Francis can be a good contributor on the ball club.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't think that's rude. I think that's totally fair. And I will say, I agree with you. Looks like a starting pitcher. Like when he's standing out there, I'm like, this guy looks the part. And I'm like, that's a lot of life. It's, you know, fake it till you make it. Just looks the part.
Yeah. Perception, reality.
Yeah, 100%. And yeah, you're right. His miss is like I think it was the third home run. He hung a slider in the dead middle of the plate. And I went, oh, that's not going to work. That's you can't have those ones. Like, of course, it's the Houston Astros. That's going out. And I got a little nervous. But then I did think he settled into the game a bit. And even though, what did he finish with? Six earned against? I can't remember if it was five or six. But I actually thought that after 4-0, he looked like he settled in a bit. And I really liked his post game where he spoke about that it being learning experiences and he wasn't letting himself get too down. And sure, we'll see it the next time he goes out there. But I weirdly didn't hate it as much as I thought I would hate it through the first three innings, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, a presentation, right? You can just tell, and he didn't look rattled. And I think that is so much of the process of a young player getting in is, like you just said, do you look the part? And can you look the part when you're getting it handed to you? Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest thing is there are so many times where you see a young player out there that you believe can do it, you think can do it, but when they get into that hostile environment, they look like a deer in headlights as soon as they get two or three balls hit out of the ballpark. Mm-hmm. And he was not that guy. He was kind of the same even keel level. And that's what you're looking for. And that's going to bode so well for him as he continues to mature as a pitcher. And I like the guy. I like the stuff. I like what he presents. Mm-hmm. And that type of maturity on the mound to stay even keel when things aren't going your way it's a learned and experienced skill. Mm-hmm. And I think he's light years ahead of that. And he's got some really good guys to learn from. He's got Bassett. He's got Gausman. He's got Barrios. He's seeing a really good template of what it looks like to be a major leaguer.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you want. And everybody frets over the offense and rightfully so. You do have to give some credit to Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro. They have nailed the pitching side of this. I mean, for a couple of years now, and it looks like another year going to be added onto this. They have really done a nice job pitching wise, getting this team into a position where they need to be. And that is some difficult decisions to be made year in, year out. Pitching is always in high demand. They have really nailed it. So if their pitching can stay healthy, can do what they did last year, and they can just figure out the hitting, you've seen the sky can be the limit for this team when they score 6, 7, 8 runs. Could be a fun summer.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case, especially given that you could end up having Manoah back at some point this season. I actually didn't follow up on how it went with the simulated start, but yeah, even for this team last night, the bullpen comes in and Garcia looks awesome. And I will admit that I was pretty nervous watching Chad Green, especially when he started his first two batters in the ninth with, you know, 3-0 counts. And I was like, this is what I need Romano back. But other teams though, would not be in as nearly as good of a position. That was the perspective that I kept trying to keep in those moments was, yeah, you feel nervous. Duh, they lost their closer and setup man. But you'd feel far more nervous if you were a lot of other ball clubs in the same scenario and that those guys are coming back. Oh, and there's a dude you haven't seen before from Cuba who just pitched lights out in Buffalo and maybe is coming up as a, I would say, the bar has to be better than Wes Parsons is already far exceeded for him, just even with the Buffalo start. So I'm excited about them adding even more depth to that area. Caleb, thanks as always for making time, brother. It's always fun getting to pick your brain.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks, JD. See you.
Take care. Caleb Joseph, Blue Jays studio analyst. Yeah. Awesome moment, stressful moment. There's going to be some times where when they're not hitting, it's not going to feel very fun at all. It's going to feel very bad. It's going to feel like yesterday where it's a, you know, new feels like old, right? Feel like you're just getting a hand-me-down here from, like, it's the hand-me-down season. But the spin is that you got a lot of emotional, like, there's a lot of passion behind this, you know, people are engaged, and I'd rather have that. I'd rather have the engagement than the malaise. Anyways, quick break. Let's come back. Hit what we missed. All right. Simon, Mike, and Armin, what'd we miss? Let's start with the Growlers things. That's sad. I didn't know.
Yeah, the Newfoundland Growlers, ECHL, terminated. They're done. They ceased operations effective immediately. Obviously, a rough story in general, and also a terrible story in terms of we've lost a truly great sports logo, mm-hmm. that Growlers logo. Our friend Matt Hayes has a Growler hat, which is always a great look.
It is a good look.
Sick logo. Tough stuff. You hate to see stuff like that. But I mean, I got immediately thinking of, like, what other great sports, now defunct sports logos are there out there that we miss? And you know, let's pour one out for some of the great sports logos that are gone.
Were the Growlers before the Golden Knights? Just, like, using that, like, pretty much exact color scheme.
The team began to play in 2018-19, according to this.
So, they had the Vegas stuff first.
Yeah.
Because, it's a nice, it's a good scheme, but it was a great logo, the dog.
Something about the dog in Newfoundland, too, where you're just like, this fits. I like it.
Yeah, it was good. I will admit, I haven't looked into any of the, why they lost the team outside of what I'm guessing, which is that it's in Newfoundland and really hard to keep that afloat. That's my guess. But that sucks because I think it's cool having a team in Newfoundland. Like, I like that. I enjoyed that in general. I'm going to Newfoundland for the first time this summer. I'm very excited.
Oh, man, I'm jealous. That's on my short list of places I really want to go.
Only place in Canada I haven't been.
Let's go.
So, very excited. Sad that they're losing the team for sure. Great logo, you're right. Like, something where when I first saw it, I'm like, damn, they nailed the marketing of this. Like, perfect, perfect hit. Defunct sports logos, obviously my first thoughts go to the Seattle Supersonics.
Of course.
But, like, specifically the city within the basketball, which has been taken and stolen by a million different places, right? Like, let's say a lot of different things have done homages to that. Because I think that is one of the more classic logos in all of sports. But if you actually, and I'm not trying, like, I know I am a Sonics fan, but if you go through the history of the Seattle Supersonics logos, they got a lot of bangers.
Sure.
Like, they got a lot of sweet, sweet logos. Obviously, I think Hartford Whalers.
Yeah.
But for me, it's more the logo is pretty sweet now that I think about it, but it's, like, more the entire sweater and the uniform than it is simply the logo.
The Whalers, you mean?
Yeah. But the Whalers logo is also pretty great.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. Those are the first two that come to mind. I don't know.
Ducks. First thing that comes to mind, the old Ducks logo.
Oh, so we're including not defunct franchises. We're including, like, who changed off their logo with this?
Open-ended question.
Okay.
The thing about the Ducks that makes it worse, too, is that, like, their current logo stinks.
Yeah. Which Ducks, though? Not the one with the stick.
The one with the two sticks across, like, the skull mask. And, like, they used to have the purple in there integrated more as well.
That's not, like, one I cry about.
I don't know why that one hits the JS Jaguar era.
The Ducks current logo stinks.
It's terrible.
The Ducks suffered from the same thing that the Blue Jays suffer from. They went, we got to get serious. We can't be the joke team. We can't be the Mighty Ducks
anymore.
And then
we got Muscle Bird.
Yeah.
Muscle Flexing
and that,
Jay.
And that's it. But no, I mean the Blue Jays, like, recently with the offense where they went, we got to get serious. We got to tighten up what I was just talking about with Caleb. And they went, we can't be the Mighty Ducks. It's the Disney jersey. It's the soft one. Yeah, I guess it's a pretty damn good. Yeah, like, I agree. I thought you meant at first, like, my first thought went to the duck holding the stick, like the duck skin.
Like the cartoon.
Yeah, I was like, that one, the actual one from the movie. Nah, that one. You're right. The duck mask with the sticks is a pretty damn good logo. And, yeah, the now just webbed D.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it's
awful. It's so boring.
And their jerseys are bad now, yeah. And they had good ones. It's like, yeah, what? They really do just got to scrap it and go back.
100%.
They got to scrap it and go back. I would say that basically, dude, you go through, if we're doing just defunct logos, and I know that we're very much in the, everybody says era now, which kind of, I've started saying it and I hate it that I say it. But
I like that you checked yourself in real time.
I know, but
there.
I was going to say that we're in a very vintage era, which, damn it, you got me. Saying era is tough, you know, especially being a guy in his 30s. But we are in a vintage era, and a lot of these things look way better than even I felt about them at the time. Like, I didn't think that the Sabres sweaters that they wore yesterday were the best at the time. I was like, eh, that's nothing. And now I look at them, and I'm like, I love those
ones. That's kind of cool,
yeah. Like, when they brought in the new Sabres rebrand, which was, again, the old one where they went back and said retro, like, all these things, old is new, blah, 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 whatever the time and space. But at the time, I was never like, wow, these red and black Sabres uniforms are the best.
Yeah, they're going to go down.
And now whenever they wear them, I'm like, woo! Those look good. Those look damn good. So I know part of it is that, part of it is nostalgia, whatever. But I think if you're looking at like defunct logos, basically anything from that 90s period versus what we've done now with logos, it's dominant for the 90s, where they like far more creativity. Actually, shout out to Alex Wong and his book, because he's got a chapter about basically the way that a lot of the guy that designed a lot of these logos, the firm that designed a lot of these logos and uniform combinations, and they're so cool and creative. And I do feel like there was an era of, this is now professional sports. This is professional sports. We're getting rid of some of the cartoony elements of this. And it has backfired and looks stupid, like the Ducks D. The Ducks D is... Maybe,
a lot of it is like being phrased as modern design when it's literally just minimalist.
Basketball jerseys got really bad for a while there, where they were just literally like one color with the city or team name, and that was it.
That's what I mean. I hate those ones.
Look at the Pistons. What it used to be what it is now. One of the worst upgrades. Oh my
God. The Pistons with like the line
I will
that
say
across.
That the Pistons.
Or sorry, the Pistons.
Here's the problem with basketball now is that everybody has a basketball logo. They're all like that. Remember when I said the Sonics one was cool? That's because the Sonics one was like one of the very first ones where it was like inside of a half basketball and the city was inside of it. But like, I am very partial to the Detroit Pistons. Out of all the basketball logos, all the round, this is a ball logo. The Pistons one I do like. So you're saying that you like the teal one?
Yeah, the like Grand the Hill? Teal with the fire coming out of the exhaust and the horse.
That one I don't like, because the Pistons to me were a classic franchise that had the Bad Boys Pistons, and they had like multiple championships with, you know, Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars and Bill
Laimbeer.
Just
like the blue and red. And
it was just that was them. And so that one I actually think was too far of a departure from something that had success. Once you become a classic franchise, I'm sorry, you got to stick with that plane. And actually the minimalism and the simplistic stuff is better. But if you are the Anaheim Mighty Ducks, don't try to be the Anaheim Ducks with a very serious logo like you've been around, like you're a classic heritage brand. Like, don't be doing that. You know, Raptors have done the same thing with some of their uniforms, where you're like, this is it? Like, Raptors?
Please, no more gold.
The logos.
A plea.
Last night, because anytime the Lakers wear not one of their two Lakers jerseys, plus it was the Raptors gold versus the Lakers black, it was just an absolute travesty of a jersey combo last night in the Raptors game. And also watching the Raptors, also a travesty.
Yeah, but like, you know what I mean about the, like, the Pistons thing is, imagine if the Celtics tried to really change the logo. Like, imagine if the Lakers tried to, that's how I feel with the Pistons. So that's why it didn't work for me, is because I grew up a 90s kid who idolized 80s basketball and whose parents cared about it. And so the Pistons to me were like a massive team. Like, that's a massive deal. So to see them move it, I went, nah. But I'm with you on a lot of stuff. And I do think that that Pistons logo looks cool. Like, the Detroit Pistons, the teal one that Grant Hill wore looks cool. But I'm not.
Maybe it's better
for like streetwear. But not necessarily the jersey itself.
I'm not a fan of classic teams messing with classic stuff. I think it's super bad. Like, I don't agree. I would say that if it's like, again, nothing is defunct anymore, because teams always like wear the logo. So that's why I went with Sonics, is because I love the Vancouver Skate, for example.
Yes.
But now they wear it again. So it's like, it's not defunct.
Full
it's
time.
Like, but again, when I first saw the new Canucks jerseys, the ones they still wear now, or the versions that they wear now, I thought, man, these look amazing. And I still think that they look good. So I like the balance of being able to mix those ones up. I don't think that you need it. Like, you can mix the retros in. I think what we need is a limitation of more of the like special design jerseys where, you know, people get upset about this, but I like the Leafs wearing black. I hate it. I think it looks so stupid and it's just, yeah.
Anytime the Celtics have a playoff game and they're not wearing either white or green, I'm furious. No, I absolutely hate it. Anyway. Couple logos here for you. The Expos, obviously we all love the Expos.
Yeah.
Pandering more to the to our friends in Quebec, the Nordiques logo, classic.
Yeah, Nordiques logo, I gotta say, is actually
really good one.
Expos, I like. I don't love as much as others. I think again, the color scheme is nice that they had for the city, but to me, Nordiques is definitely far and away. If I was doing a like, whoa, that's a sick logo. Same with like North Stars.
Actually, that's a great one. Like, here's like the North Stars. They sometimes wear like throwbacks or whatever. Like I love like the old school Houston Oilers logo, and now the Tennessee last year wore a couple.
That's a great logo.
Wore a couple throwbacks for that hilariously against Houston. Yeah. My one plea is the Winnipeg Jets. In their first iteration, had great jerseys and logo, and now they're so boring and bad, and they wear their like alternates sometimes.
Yep.
That are, you know, hearkening back to just switch to the old Jets logo or something that's more close to that, because the current Jets Winnipeg Jets logos are just like they're boring and not it.
That's why people aren't going. Okay, let's get off this. We've done this for too long. What's next?
You know what? I feel like this one's going to take a while. So a viral video was going around of friends having like a night where they each prepared a PowerPoint presentation to explain to their friends what they actually do for a job. Because let's be honest, JD, we're in our mid-30s. Our friends have jobs that surely are something. I don't know what they are. Do you know what your friends do?
No.
Are you confident that you know what your friends actually do?
I hope none of them are listening to this. It's not fair because what I do is the easiest thing to understand. Like,
correct.
The only things that it's so easy to understand. Like I said, I've complained about this, but everybody thinks like they have a friend who could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I have a buddy who likes sports. I'm okay. All right. But yeah, I watch games and I read stuff and I think about what I like and then I talk about it.
Sure.
On the radio and on podcasts and people get it, you know? Pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to talk about, so people always ask you about it. Whenever you try to ask somebody else about another job, and I'll admit this, and I'm sorry to my friends for this, they are not good salesmen of their own job. So this is partially their fault, but it's partially mine. But they'll start talking about it, and they know your eyes are glazing over because you're like, whew. Okay, what is this? All right, and then there's like data, and then it's a horrible thing. Yeah,
some sort of analyst
thing.
Something.
You know, I have friends who even do jobs that are kind of easier-ish to understand, but I don't really truly get the actual intricate details, right? Like, you know, I have friends who are lawyers, but they've switched over to different types.
They're now consultants.
I'm like, okay. And then I have, you know, a great friend who is the head of like Waterloo Transportation.
Oh.
But I'm like, I don't really know what that, you know, and he explains to me sometimes. He'll talk about his job. And I'm like, okay, I kind of get that. But most jobs people tell me from the real world, unless I get it if you're like, I drive a truck. I'm like, got it.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, nice.
I work I construction. Get it. Got it.
Don't even really get that. Don't even really get that because I've never really done construction. I'm not overly handy. And I feel like if you put me at a construction site, unless you told me like, do this exactly right now, like one thing, then I would never. Yeah. I don't know how things get built. You know, like people say construction. I'm like, so you what? You stand around all day with a hard hat and a vest and eat sandwiches. Huh. Nice. That pissed people off. But that's what I think. Like, you guys are constantly running coffee orders. I see you guys at McDonald's all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Taking up some of that prime real estate with a huge coffee order at Tim's.
Yeah, he's like some guy's like holding out the thing and yeah, he's there for a long time. That's basically the extent of what I know about construction work. But I have no idea what any of my friends do, really. Yeah. Like deep down, no clue whatsoever. Very hard for me to understand, very hard for me to listen. But also people, you know, if you really want, this is my advice to you people out in the real world. If you want us to really know what you do, think about it before you answer the question and actually do a better job of explaining it. And don't try to like, zhuzh it up, you know?
So that's
like,
the thing.
Just say what it is. Like, don't try to start getting into, and then the thing is like you add these unnecessary layers and we go, all right, like,
I think sometimes people get caught up in doing the whole, like, what they would say in an interview where you're really trying to explain what you're doing, but, like, make it seem fancier. You know what I mean? Like, if I was telling a hiring manager what my job, like, I would exaggerate all sorts of stuff or what, like, just tell me what it is you do on a day-to-day basis, and I might have some sort of lasting memory of what your job actually is.
Here's what I truly feel, too, about this, now that I think about it. I'm usually, like, more impressed when someone has a job and they go, yeah, it's just kind of like this, and they really oversimplify it.
Yeah.
You go, oh, you don't need anybody's approval here.
Sure.
The longer you talk about what you do,
yeah,
there's probably like a direct correlation to salary and the way you feel about it. The more layers you need to add of, but I also do this and this and this, and then you go, okay, versus a guy who's like, yeah, I work in securities. Yeah. Like, I don't know what that means. Like, oh, hey. But then you go, I'm not asking you for the question because I don't want to seem dumb. I don't know. I'm probably, he or she is probably like, you listen, you're not even going to get it. So why am I going to get into this? So let's just keep it as one little quick thing. And you go, all right. Like, okay. No further questions at this time. You know, that's real confidence. Yeah. I don't need your approval. I already know what I do is so, not important, but yeah, valuable that I'm not going to go into this. The longer the explanation, the worse the job is.
Yeah, sure. Well, and my main job, for those that don't know, is I work at Sportsnet on the TV side of things. It's also kind of a bad one to explain because it's like, you know, I work on Sportsnet Central and I'm an associate producer and I
No, but that's what I mean. You just need to shorten it up. You just
100%.
Need to shorten it up.
But my funny thing, too, is that like my parents, to this day, granted, they're in their 70s, but they have no clue of what I actually do. Like, I remember a couple years ago, my dad was watching the Rogers Cup, watching the tennis tournament, and I just got a random text from him that said, is that you? And I said, is what me? And he said, was that you on the replay doing the replays? I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, that's a tough text.
What did he think that I was doing?
He was trying to connect with you. Your parents are just so disappointed in you, eh?
Oh, 100%.
My here's the thing.
My dad's a professor of chemical engineering.
I was going to say, is that your parents, it's not that they can't understand what you do, it's that whenever they try to really think about it, it breaks their hearts so much that they have to look away. That they start getting into it, and they're like, this is too painful. Yeah. This is too painful. Let's just not. So that's the most he can muster up is when he sees tennis, he's like, is this you? And then you're like, pardon me? He's like, never mind. Back to chemical engineering. That's it.
Sorry,
that's it.
Dad.
Yeah, you should apologize.
Sorry, Dad.
You guys know what your friends do? Mike?
Some are simple, some are like complicated. Like two friends come to mind. One works at Oliver Jewelry, so that's not complicated.
Yeah,
that's kinda, free ad. Yeah. Like, okay, yeah. You pay you for that?
Yeah. Cash, man. Yeah. And then the other one is like a project manager for Johnson Controls.
Like, I was going to say, it's like project manager. I'm like, you manage the project.
Sometimes it's in the title.
Yeah, so you manage the project. The project is being managed by you.
It's also that all these jobs are like way less rigid than they used to be.
Yeah. Well, you know? Part of that is just that everybody makes everybody do a billion jobs now instead of just being great at one thing. They're like, can you also do this? There's not extra money, but we'll need you to also do this. It's a great opportunity for you. What an opportunity. There's an opportunity for Liz Morrow I got Christopher Stieg returns, and we're going to talk about power play and then Sid Sixero. See you then.